So I'm going to begin, as a lot of people have already, with the theme of the conference, which is feeling, a word which can, as people have already pointed out, mean both physical acts and emotional responses. And what my paper is going to do is explore how this inherently effective relationship between human and animal physical proximity was mediated through colonial discourse in the context of British imperial rule in Burma. Implicitly then, it's also about the silencing of Burmese ways of understanding interspecies intimacy in the colonial archive. So through romantic adventure fiction, memoirs, natural histories, scientific texts, ethnographies, travel writings and government reports, I examine the diversity of British responses to touching animals in colonial Burma. These responses were structured by several factors, of which who was touching the animal and which animal was being touched are the salient ones. And importantly, these responses were not neutral. There was a politics behind who could and could not touch this or that animal and how these encounters were portrayed. It was a politics informed by colonial society's ubiquitous concern with policing racial divisions, a concern intrinsically bound up with anxieties over sexuality. So, as a bit of brief background, this is a map of British India showing Burma, as you can see on the right hand side. Isn't Burma big? I always point this out to my students, make me seem important. And it was ruled as a province of Raj from 1886 onwards, although parts of it had been colonised in the preceding decades. So reflecting the racial division, which I already picked up, my paper is going to look at relationships between the colonised and animals, and then look at relationships between the coloniser and animals, and hopefully play with this division a little bit. So to start with colonised animal interactions, as they are represented by the British, these imperial commentators usually drew attention to the physical and emotional closeness the Burmese were said to have with them. And these portrayals were not uniformly negative, and nor were they uniform in content, but they did all serve to mark out the Burmese as other and inferior, with varying degrees of subtlety and success. A central marker for this was religion. Burmese Buddhism was characterised by one 19th century British travel writer as having a pitying love for animals. However, the sharpness of this binary is complicated by further differentiation of the Burmese population by ethnicity. The Karen ethnic group, for example, emerged by the mid-19th century as an important group for colonial knowledge of Burmese animals because of their reputation as jungle-residing hunters, and also because of the penetration of Christian missionaries within some sections of their communities. Their alleged closeness to animals made them simultaneously crucial intermediaries for the generation of colonial knowledge on natural history, but also made them targets for racist characterizations as primitive. Now, these are this more sort of sweeping range of colonial representations. There's a greater range of responses can be found when we look at more specific physical relationships, and I'm going to look at just three here: the relationship between Burmese elephant drivers, called Uzis, and their elephants, representations of snake charmers, and claims that Burmese women breastfed animals. And I'll begin with the Uzis. Now, a lot of British commercial activities were entirely dependent on elephant labour, and elephant labour itself was entirely dependent on the training of these Uzis to be able to command them. And although some saw these Uzis as lazy and untrustworthy, reproducing colonial discourses, others, such as the Bombay Burma Trading Corporation veteran James Elephant Bill Williams, regarded them as an indispensable source of knowledge and skill. In his memoir and in a semi-fictionalized account he wrote, both in the 1950s, he emphasized that he learned about elephants not from his fellow officers in the company, most of whom he thought were drunkards, but from his Uzis. He also drew repeated parallels between the Uzis and their elephants in their life cycles, particularly around adolescence and lust, and their temperaments. Both were said to be docile, but dangerous and uncontrolled when provoked. And this was particularly apparent in some of the photographs and set in his memoir called Elephant Bill. For instance, in this picture here, in which the Uzi is described as being almost part of the animal. Beneath the image, the physicality of both is commented upon, including their colour and the nature of their skin. And as Philippa Levine has pointed out, depictions of nudity in partial undress, such as this, can be used to connote base savagery, but also can be used in high aesthetics. And I think in this case, actually, these depictions of Uzis are doing something slightly different to both of those, and that is to highlight the emotional and tactile connections between himself, the Uzi, and the elephant. The photos are intended to show an intimate and innate connection between the two, a naturalistic portrayal that masks the more fraught relations of forestry labour. Now, this romantic portrayal of the Uzi's relationship with working elephants is based upon the positive image of elephants in the British imagination, as Harry Ritvo has talked about. They were sort of honorary good animals amongst the wild animals. Now, this is something which certainly doesn't hold for snakes, who are firmly in the bad category. And the difference in part of these representations is a sort of unnaturalness about handling snakes in an intimate way. In 1897, in her book Picturesque Burma, Alice Hart remarked on the habit of some in Burma to keep pythons as pets. She also talked about the government of Burma's attempts to have poisonous snakes destroyed and how that backfired as Burmese or entrepreneurial Burmese had started breeding them in order just to have them killed and get the money reward from the state. Her comments about the venom and general untrustworthy nature of snakes injected a sense of jeopardy into these observations. Now, in literary portrayals, these images of snake charmers are gendered further. In her scandalous and genuinely shocking 1901 novel, Anna Lombard, the new woman novelist, Victoria Cross, which is a fantastic pseudonym, described a dance performed by an 11-year-old Burmese girl with a snake. In the scene, a desperately lonely and lovelorn young official, male official, is being tempted and almost seduced by this child and her charmed snake. Now, the narrative purpose of this episode is to establish the character's earnest suppression of his libido and to detail what the author imagines to be the psychological effects of his repression on his masculinity. In line with this plot, he resists the temptations of the writhing combinations of the girl and snake. And the author in this is building on criticisms of officials in Burma who take temporary wives of the Burmese. And the Burmese in this discourse are seen as seductive Burmese women. And so it's part of a broader criticism of imperial masculinity. However, the scene is curiously echoed in a more conventional imperial novel set in Burma, which is completely absent of any critique of male desire, called Fascination. And this was written by a long-standing judge called Cecil Champion Lewis, and is written a decade later. And the colonial official who's being captivated by this young Burmese female snake charmer turns out to be as deadly and as deceptive as her trained snakes. And Lewis's portrayal is a condemnation of female sexual desire. So it's directly opposite to Anna Lombard. However, in both scenes, the physical intimacy of the Burmese woman with the snake is intended to be erotic in an unsettling way. As in both novels, the characters also reveal revulsion at the sensuousness of these displays. So literary depictions of snake charming are not the only gendered and sexualized images of Burmese intimacy with animals I've found. There are repeated references to the belief that Burmese women will breastfeed orphaned elephants or bears. Now, the celebrated veterinarian Griffith Evans, who spent a decade in Burma studying elephants, took this photograph of a young woman breastfeeding an elephant on the Thai side of the Thai-Burma border. The juxtaposition of the human child on one breast and the elephant on the other emphasizes her physical proximity to the animal and produces a sense of the act as unnatural. This is a clearly very staged and posed photograph. It is not merely attempting to document a practice, it is producing the practice by moving it from the anecdotal to the evidential. In the process, it silences the meanings and felt experiences of this interaction for the woman herself, the lonely elephant. And so it's very much a colonial image. It's a colonially produced image. And as with the photos of the Uzis discussed earlier, the undressed body is orientalizing the image, the intimacy between them. Through this sense, although this sense of intimacy is ultimately undermined by the very intrusive nature and posed nature of the photograph itself. This is also a sexualized image. Again, Elephant Bill, as one of the guys who writes about Burmese women breastfeeding bears, later in his book, he talks about a time when he's drunk and sexually frustrated in a village, and in a village in a Burmese jungle, sees a Burmese woman breastfeeding openly in public and describes his feelings of simultaneous disgust and desire. So, these portrayals of Burmese interactions with animals are similar in the sense that they emphasize racial differences through human-animal proximity. But there is some ambivalence here too. The sexualized portrayal of female snake charmers and breastfeeding suggest a complex and contradictory combination of disgust and desire within colonial discourse. So the distancing effect of describing physical and emotional intimacy of the colonized with animals was a strand of colonial discourse that sat uncomfortably alongside ample evidence of British interactions. This was an unacknowledged tension. This apparent contradiction was masked by imperial claims through a scientific mode of relating to animals. This was supported by a contrast of Burmese apparent cruelty or superstitious relationships. By the second half of the 19th century, imperial natural historians and zoologists displayed themselves as removed, detached observers. But of course, these written performances were based on material connections with animals, and the effective labour of these connections are also suppressed in this writing style. But in other sources, we do get a sense of the more effective relationships that the British had with animals, particularly in travel writing. And this comes out particularly in regards to pets and pests. And start talking about the pets to start with. The mid-19th century natural historian Francis Mason, who was also a missionary, briefly noted the domestication of otters by Burmese in the 1850s as something which the British could pick up when they were in Burma. And he also notes a British guy who domesticates a tapir, who describes as friendly but ugly. So in the 19th century, there is some attempts to the British to domesticate Burmese wildlife, and this is part of a broader process to domesticate Burmese practices and cultural lives in their homes. But by the 20th century, most of the pets they have are far more typical, in a sense, and are overwhelmingly dogs. And as Erica's work has shown, having pets is an inherently imaginative encounter between the pet owner and the pet. Because the relationship involves attempting to understand that familiar animal which you're sharing your life with. And this imaginative work was very clear in a traveller's account of Burma from 1909, purportedly written by a dog. The dog was called John. He travelled to the northern roast regions of the colony with his master, the colonel's wife and their female friend, and the entourage of Indian servants and heavily loaded ponies. John himself was a Burmese dog, who found these unusual white people intriguing, although as a Buddhist he disapproved of their hunting. Throughout the book he provides a wry commentary on the foibles of these colonials who make eager travellers but are ultimately ill at ease in Burma. And although somewhat independent and very sarcastic animal, John makes his home with this family and sets himself into a cosy life. Now, writing from a perspective of this dog, naive in the ways of colonial British society, enabled the real author to poke light-hearted fun at the British in Burma, particularly women. And this light-hearted humour was a way of sort of embedding the British in Burma's wildlife. It was not, however, a representative portrayal of the lives of domesticated dogs in the colony. Elephant Bill's dogs and their sad fates are probably a better sign of this. Bilu, described as a black ball of fluff, died of pneumonia. Sally, a bull terrier. Williams drowned after she'd become lame from hookworm. Carl died after severing his jugular vein on an iron stake whilst chasing another dog. Molly Mia was shot by Williams when he suspected of her having rabies. Jabbo was killed either by a Burmese worker or by having his, was probably killed by a Burmese worker who hit him with a paddle. And there were many others who died in their own uniquely tragic circumstances, on more than one occasion being eaten by a leopard. These passages in Williams's books, in which he reminisces about his pets, consists of a litany of grim and grisly deaths. But the relationship with these pets serves to ground him in Burma. Every fresh cause for grief strengthened the emotional attachment to the place and heightened the post-imperial nostalgia of his memoir. But it was not only domesticated animals that the British came to encounter and deal with when they were there. There are also all sorts of other pests, things they didn't want around them, which they were having to engage with. And Geraldine Mitten, describes her experiences with working with timber traders in the north of the country, how they were set upon by swarms of wasps and attacked by hairy caterpillars and bitten by innumerable mosquitoes. And her retelling of these stories of reproducing their performance of masculinity, the performance of owning or coming to own the Burmese wilderness, jungle, as they sort of describe it. But they describe themselves as jungle wallers. And curiously enough, they start to write about these things after they've been in it for a long period of time. The narrative arc is that they start to miss mosquito bites and the itching. They start to miss the noise of the pests. So it's a way of developing their familiarity with it. So to conclude, as far as I can from some of these things, the British relationships with these pests and pets also serves to sort of base themselves in there. But there's an ambivalence again. These animals are both irritants and balms. They are pests and pets. And this ambivalence perhaps reveals a broader colonial anxiety about not being at home in imperialism, which is something which people have written about elsewhere. So my very, very last paragraph on summing up here is to reflect on some of the history of colonial Burma so far, which has been bringing out more and more the ambivalences of colonial discourse, its diversity, its lack of uniformity, and some people say that as a result of this, it isn't really a nexus of power knowledge which is controlling or representing the Burmese in a particular way. But I reject that conclusion, even though I do see ambivalences and diversity within colonial discourse. These depictions were not monolithic or straightforward, and they were marked by ambivalence, but nevertheless, there was a discernible politics to these representations through which the Burmese and the British were differentiated. So although in colonial discourse, both the British and the Burmese were connected to animals, the politics of these representations kept them apart from one another.